Yesterday, I made a reference to the part played by space and time in our awareness of things. One of our friends here has requested me to speak a little more, dilating upon the subject of space and time. Though whatever I have spoken yesterday is quite sufficient for the purpose of conducting our consciousness in meditation. To explain what space is and how it influences our evaluation of objects, we have to analyze a little bit the circumstances under which space becomes a vital part of our experience. Space is a relation between objects, especially a relation between the perceiver and the perceived. This is one of its special characteristics among many others. There cannot be an externalized perception unless there is a relation. The very meaning of externalization is capability to get related externally. When we say there is an object, we imply thereby that there is also an observer of the object. There is a further implication that this observation of the object is through a relation. Now, this relation is impossible unless there is a third element between the observer and the observed. This differentiating element between the observer and the observed is space and time combined together. This was the subject we were speaking about yesterday. While it is true that as far as we are concerned in our practical life, this amount of understanding of the nature of space and time will do, the question takes us far deeper than this mere definition that space-time in a combined manner exists as a relationship between the subject observing and the object observed. Without this third link being intimately connected with the observer and the observed, it cannot become a link like the umpire in a game. The third element is connected both with the object that is observed and the observing consciousness. It is on account of this double activity of this presence called space-time that perception or an awareness of the objects outside becomes possible. This means that the object is in space and time, and the observing subject also is in space and time. Both are located in space and time, and it may appear on a superficial definition that space, time transcend the subjectivity of the observer and the objectivity of the object. Transcendence in the sense that it is capable of bringing together into a sort of union two unrelated elements, the observer and the observed. But what sort of connecting link is this space-time between the observer and the observed? It is a relation between two terms. Now, peculiarly enough, the terms cannot be explained without the relation, and the relation cannot be explained without the terms. The two terms are the two elements which space-time connects are explicable only in terms of this relation. It is something like a definition that we give of an object, which is always with reference to something else. Qualities or attributes with which we define objects are not independent existences, but are only relative, in the sense that they are meaningful only by an exclusion of characters other than themselves. White is other than what is not white, red is other than what is not red, and so on and so forth. You cannot know what is a cow if there are no objects other than cows. So exclusion is a part of definition. When we explain or define the terms of the relation called space-time, we find that such a definition is difficult enough, because a term by itself, taken independently by itself, has no characters which are definable. So that you cannot give an independent explanation of an object. The explanation or definition of an object is only in relation or with reference to what connects it or with what it is connected. This becomes a little more intelligible to us when we compare this space-time relation of objects and subjects as we see it in the condition of dream. We have space-time and objects in dream also. I am giving this analogy only to give you an idea as to what this relationship means in its vital connection with the terms related. The objects of dream are not independent of the space-time in dream. You know how it is so. The mental functions, psychological conditions of the individual dreaming are responsible for the projections in dream. The conditions responsible for the dream as a whole are also responsible for the nature of the space-time projected and of the objects that are made visible to the dreamer. There is a single conditioning factor which has manifested itself in a variety of forms as space, time and cause and object and observer. All these things that you have in dream are manifestations of a single conditioning factor which has become responsible for the dream. Likewise, it appears that there is a supernormal conditioning factor which may be said to be responsible for the manifestation of what you call space-time and also the objects and the observers thereof. This supposed existence of a transcendent conditioning factor of space-time, objects and subjects has bred a philosophical doctrine especially prevalent in the West, not unknown to the East, namely the distinction between primary and secondary qualities. The primary qualities, so-called, are what are supposed to be attributes of objects independent of relation. Whether such attributes exist or not, we shall see a little later. But this is the assumption at least, that there are objects in the world and they have certain characters of their own, independent of the factor of their being observed by someone else. That means to say, certain objects, or perhaps all objects, will have certain characters or attributes of their own, even if you are not to know them or see them. Such characters are generally called primary qualities. The primary qualities are something like mass, extension, motion, etc. of things. But the related qualities, qualities that are superimposed upon the object, or qualities which are apparently present in the object only during the time of perception or cognition, are called secondary qualities. For example, sound, touch, etc. Sound, tangibility, color, taste, etc. are regarded as secondary qualities of objects, not necessarily inherent independently in the objects themselves in the way in which they are experienced by subjects. And so a distinction is drawn between what are called primary qualities and secondary qualities by philosophers. The reason for this distinction drawn is the assumption again that there is such a thing as an independent cosmos, other than our mental operations. There is a universe which is extra mental. So that we may say, everything is not a mental creation merely. There is a universe which is definable by characters independent of qualities that are observed only during the perception of the universe. This comes out from the analogy that I gave you of the perceptions in dream, that the entire dream process is made possible by a single factor, which is the reason behind the rise of dream itself. And this factor, in a very strange manner as though, become space, time, objects, causality, and the subject observed in dream. How it happens is a wonder by itself. How the mind manifests itself in all these ways. There is a causal, logical reason in dream. Everything is not slipshod and chaos there. There is tremendous reason and science and logicality. There are objects which affect you pleasurably and miserably. There is space, time, there is every blessed thing that you see in waking. But with all these externalities, separations, isolated locations and varieties that you see in dream, you know very well on a subsequent analysis and examination thereof, that the space, time and the objects are both mental. So it appears that the objects are independent of space time. We don't run after space and time, we run after only objects, which is a proof that the mind takes objects as independent by themselves. In the dream condition, the objects which affect us in a pleasant or miserable manner are taken as existent by themselves independently. We have friends and enemies even in dream. There are objects which we like and dislike in dream. But these objects are peculiar externalizations of certain conditions of the psychological organ. But this psychological organ in its manifestation as objects has also played the trick of expressing itself as also the necessary space and time together with the manifestation of this object, so that a reality may be bestowed upon the object. The mind is wonderful. Its workings are miraculous. How beautifully it manifests itself as all the necessary conditions which are needed to make us believe in the reality of objects externally. Now this analogy will tell us that the conditions of space and time which are necessary for our belief in the reality of objects and objects themselves are both projections of the psychological order. Not merely the space time there and the object, but also the observer himself is conditioned by the factors of dream, so that the dreamer is taken aback by the horrors of dream or is pleased by the pleasurable objects of dream. Which means to say that the dreaming consciousness is involved in the conditions responsible for dream. So that the whole world is one setup which connects all factors in a network. But who connects this into a network? This question as to who could do it has given rise to the doctrine of the primary qualities and the independent existence of the cosmos. If we are not to believe in the independent existence of the universe outside us, we cannot explain how this miracle could be worked at all, because no particular individual can be regarded as the creator of the world. No one would deliberately create a prison for one's own self. No one would like to suffer deliberately, and yet suffering comes upon person. There is what is called chance and fate and accident, which takes possession of the lives of people and gives us the proof that there are powers and laws which operate beyond the possibilities of mental operations of man. Space and time, on account of this reason, are regarded as real as well as ideal. I have given you the reason why they are real and why they are ideal. They are ideal because they are necessarily connected with the observing process in the observation of an object. But they are real in the sense that they condition even the observer himself, so that, as we tried to discuss yesterday, everything in the universe may be regarded as phenomenal. This ideality and reality, whatever it be, of the setup of space and time has also another peculiar characteristic. There are many features of space and time, all of which we cannot discuss in one day. I am taking up only one or two, or perhaps two or three of them. The other aspect of space and time is that space and time cannot be a single permanent factor under every condition. It is not true that there is only one order of space-time in the entire creation. We have a beautiful story about this in the Yoga Vasistha, which you all might have heard, how space-time can be relative and is relative on account of certain other factors operating behind. What are these factors? The involvement of the observing subject in space-time is the cause of space-time being relative. You may ask me, what do you mean by relative? It means that it is subject to alteration in accordance with the condition of the observing subject. In the modern theory of relativity, it is said that space-time changes their form and condition in accordance with the location, the position, and the velocity of the observer. Your speed of motion and the position in which you are placed will also determine the character of space-time in relation to the object that you perceive. The conditions of the observer which determine to a large extent the nature of space-time connecting the object are psychological in a very, very special sense. Here, by the word psychological, I do not mean psychology in the ordinary popular sense of the term. It is psychology in the deepest sense, as yoga would take it perhaps. The entire determining conditions of the individuality of the human being may be regarded as psychological conditions. Not merely the thinking faculty, not merely the self-arrogating faculty, not merely the remembering faculty or the understanding or the willing, but all these put together and what is much more within us. These conditions about which we have studied some time back also, if you could recall to your mind, these conditions making up our personality are largely responsible also for the character of space-time determining our objects of perception in a particular world into which we are born. The samskaras within us, the impressions of perceptions of the past, the tendencies, the desires, fulfilled as well as unfulfilled. In short, whatever is within us, making us what we are in our individuality and personality, have a direct impact upon the external atmosphere into which we are born. And we have a corresponding type of space-time into which we are set to be born. That is what we call rebirth in a new world. When we die, we are reborn in a new world, we say. Where is this new world? Is it above us or below us or right or left? Where do you find this world into which we are born after die? Where is that world? How far is it? It is not far away, it is just here where we are. But it is a different condition and order of space-time. Where is dream? It is just here where you are sitting. It is not somewhere far off. Though the dream world is entirely different from the waking world in every respect prior, it is just where you are sitting under your very nose. It is not away physically or geographically. Likewise, the world into which we are born after our death is just here, inside this very hall. It is not far off. Hell and heaven are here itself. But they appear to be very far, entirely unconnected with the previous experience and the previous realm into which we are born, on account of a new atmosphere that we create by the projection of our psychological conditions again I have to underline in a very special sense to be used. So the space-time condition determining the nature of the objects of our experience are vitally connected with our personalities, and they go on changing every time our personality gets changed. Does it mean that there is a world for each individual then? Not necessarily. Though sometimes under special abnormal conditions of the mind we seem to be in a world of our own. But we need not take this as a general feature of our experience. It is something abnormal and very special, occurring only sometimes, not always. We can be born into a common world of perception and experience on account of the similarity of the conditioning factors. If all people die in a boat sinking, what is the sin that all people have committed? You may ask me. All have committed the same sin. Otherwise, why everybody should go into the water at one stroke? Well, it does not mean that everyone has identically performed the same kind of mistake, but there are certain similarities. We are human beings. We call ourselves humanity, mankind. We are humanity or mankind because of certain general characteristics among us. But it does not mean that we are all identical among ourselves. Each person is different in every character from every other person in the world. Yet, we have a special general characteristic called man species. We belong to the species of mankind, humanity. And we distinguish ourselves from other beings like animals, etc. Notwithstanding the fact that we have peculiarities of our own which manifest themselves whenever they are necessary. We don't die at the same moment always. We have got different types of experience under different conditions, which makes us feel and realize that there are independent factors in us in spite of our generality of the human species. Likewise, there are certain conditions which become responsible for our being born into a common world. Many of us are in a single world of this earth, for example, this earth plane. This earth plane is a single common experience for all of us. It is a particular space-time into which we are born. But this particular space-time is necessitated by the collective activity of the psychological tendencies of all the individuals born into this world. As sometimes we say, Christ is the Son of Man. What do you mean by Son of Man? Everybody is Son of Man. Well, it is a special meaning. He is the Son of Mankind, not Son of one man. Christ is a force, or for the matter of that, any incarnation of divinity is a force summoned by the collective asking of humanity. So that you can say mankind has given birth to this incarnation. So we say Christ is the Son of Man. We may say likewise, similarly, this particular system of reference called space-time into which we have been born and which we are experiencing and under which condition we are contacting objects, all these is necessitated by or summoned by or required by the collective force of the psychological tendencies of all the individuals born into this setup. Some psychologists call this a collective unconscious, like Carl Jung. This is a new term coined by him, but we also are aware of this term much before his birth. Collective unconscious is the basic repository of psychological stuff which conditions entire human species, not merely one individual. And this peculiar collective unconscious to which I am making a reference is something transcending even humans, because it has engendered the birth of the whole world, not merely the human species. The story in the Yoga Vasishtha, which demonstrates this truth of the relativity of space and time, must be known to all of you. The story of Leela, I am not going to give a detailed description of it because most of you, perhaps all of you, have read it. The story of Leela and Padma, as given in the Yoga Vasishtha, a very interesting, absorbing story which you must read if you have not read, tries to prove how the vastness of space, the immensity of time and duration can be purely conditioned by psychological necessity. Vastness of space is not an absolute fact. It is relative to certain conditions. Even without making you refer to the story of Leela and Padma in the Yoga Vasishtha, you can have reference to your own dream world. What a vast space is the space of dream, but it is contained within your head. You are only imagining that space. It is not wider than the space inside your room in which you are sleeping. You travel to a long distance in a jet plane, in a dream world, without moving from the bed. You are on the same spot. There can be motion even without real motion. There can be travel without real travel. There can be expansion without real expansion. So space, time and objects can be there even if they are really not there, because of the necessity of the psychological nature for the fulfillment of certain potencies hidden within. The length of time and the extension of space, which are intimately connected with each other, are therefore vitally related to experiencing subjects also. Space and time are not independent of each other, because you cannot think one thing without the other. When you are in space, you are also in time. You are somewhere and also somewhere. This identity of spatial and temporal characters has made people come to the conclusion, a discovery, that our grammatical usage of terms like space and time is not appropriate only. It is one factor, one condition that has split itself into space and time. If they are really two, they could be separated, but we are unable to separate them. Nor can you see space by itself without an individuality connected behind it. The assumption of individuality at once projects externality, which is the same as spatiality. The moment you begin to dream, the space of dream also is projected. Which means to say, the moment you individualize yourself, you also externalize yourself. Individualization and externalization are simultaneous or perhaps identical process. The moment you are an individual, you are also externalized into an observing subject of something outside. Now, the reality of space and time is a difficult subject to discuss because it has many colors like that of a chameleon. What space and time is cannot be defined without reference to the conditions which have been behind the manifestation of space and time. When you say space and time, you must ask whose space and time? Dreamer's space and time or waking ones or the space and time of the Gandharvas or the Pitrus or Devas or Bahaspati? You say there are so many realms. These realms are nothing but various space-time orders. You might have heard of Swargaloka, Pitraloka, Gandharvaloka, Rishiloka, Satyaloka, Vaikunthaloka, Kailasa. So many wonderful descriptions of heavenly regions and nether regions are given to us in our Puranas. Do these exist and where do they exist if they exist? Where is Indraloka? Where is Swargaloka? Where is Patala? They are all here. As I mentioned to you, just inside this bhajan hall. Vaikuntha also is here, Kailasa also is here, Naraka also is here, Yama is here, Indra is here, all are here, because all space-times are here only. They can be projected according to the condition of our consciousness. This is a mystery. There are very few textbooks which describe these mysteries. The only one that I have seen is the Yoga Vasishtha, and there is another parallel to it called the Tripura Rahasya, especially the Jnana Kanda, which goes into the depth of these mysteries of relativity of perception. I have also read a modern writer's book called the Science Fiction, which is very much akin to what we read in the Yoga Vasishtha. It is based on the theory of relativity, Einstein's theory of relativity, a book, a mentor book called the Science Fiction. Very absorbing, you will not keep that book unless you finish it. So interesting. In which he describes, to give you a diversion for the time being, that past, present and future really do not exist. What can be past can also be future to some other person. What may be past to us may be a future to someone else and a present to someone else under a different order of space and time. Mayai vaite nihata purvameva nimitta matram bhava savyasachin. I have already killed these people, says the Vishwarupa. How have you killed these people? They are still alive. The Vishwarupa in the Bhagavad Gita speaks, Arjuna, all these have been destroyed by me already. Why are you worried? You become only an instrument. You need not destroy them. They have already been destroyed by me only. Oh, you see, the future is regarded as a past. I have already destroyed them, he says. How do you say that? Because the consciousness of the Virat is different from the consciousness of individual perception. When the procession comes from Lakshman Jula and moves to Rishikesh, and the line of people is watching the procession, the Lakshman Jula people will say, it has gone. The procession has gone. It is a past. But Shivananda Ashram people will say, it has not yet come. It is not a thought. It is a future. And when it actually comes, it is a present. One and the same event can be a present and a past and a future under a different position. So while to the Virat it was a destruction that has already taken place, for Arjuna it was yet to take place. The science fiction book will tell you all these things. Past, present and future are operations of the mind, conditions of certain permutations and combinations of space-time, so that we cannot say whether we are in present or past or future. We are in a wonderful world of absorbing mysteries. I am only going into these details in answer to the request of Dr. Singh, who wanted me to enlarge upon the concept of space and time a little more, and I shall revert back to the subject which I took up yesterday, how this is an important subject to be dealt with in meditation also. I am only continuing what I said yesterday. During the practice of meditation, we are confronted with the principle of space and time, on account of which the mind gets distracted, jumps from one object to another object, and it becomes impossible for you to concentrate your mind on any particular object. The difficulty of concentration of the mind on any given object is due to the existence of space and time and the variety of objects. As long as there is a variety of things, the mind will naturally try to experiment upon the validity of its contact with various objects. Why does the mind go to objects? Because of the pleasure it seeks in things. It is distressed inside. The infinite bliss of the Absolute has been lost by the mind on account of its isolation, externalization, individualization. So it is trying to regain that infinite that has been lost. How does it gain this infinitude? By contacting infinite number of objects in a mistaken manner. Why does your mind jump in meditation? Because it wants infinitude. It is not satisfied with one object. You give a dot on the wall, or a candle flame, or a pencil, a rose. It does not want all this. It says, I want infinity. I have lost infinity and therefore give me infinity. But you are giving it only a candlestick. So it jumps and goes to some other object. But unfortunately, the poor mind does not understand what has happened to it. And it also does not know why you are giving it a candlestick rather than an infinite. You are giving it as a necessity, as a medicine for its illness. It wants the infinite, no doubt, but it cannot seek this infinite through the object. The reason is that the infinite is not an externalized condition. We concluded yesterday by saying that the universal, though it is present in every particular, is different from the particular because the particular is characterized by particularity. The object is characterized by objectness, which is not the case with the universal. Though it is true that the mind sees the universal, it cannot find it in any object, because there are two specific characters of infinity or universality. One is selfhood. I shall try to explain to you. You have mentioned it already some time back for your memory, what selfhood means. And indivisibility. Selfhood and indivisibility are the special characteristics of universality. But you cannot find these characters in an object. It has neither selfhood nor indivisibility. So, in spite of the fact that the mind goes to varieties of objects, it is not satisfied. You may give it thousands of objects for its contact and possession and enjoyment, it will remain the same crying child and very, very unhappy. Oh, I have lost something, I am not happy. Because you cannot get what you have lost by coming in contact with things which are not the characteristic of that which you have lost. The indivisibility of the universal and the selfhood of the universal cannot be seen in any object of the world. You know why the objects are not indivisible? Well, very plain truth it is, we are divided by other objects. The exclusion of themselves by other things is divisibility. But the universal is indivisible, there is nothing excluding it and it excludes nothing. So anything that excludes something is not the universal and therefore it is not the real. So my dear mind, don't go to objects. You tell it in your meditation. You have lost the indivisible and you are trying to find it in the divisible. Not possible. The other character of the universal is selfhood. Now this is a more difficult concept than even indivisibility. Selfhood is the character of subjectness. The impossibility of being converted into an object. Consciousness is of that nature. It is a self. Consciousness is the same as self. Atman is Chaitanya. Prajnanam Brahma. Consciousness is Brahman. This is the Upanishad. Consciousness is the subject and consciousness alone can be the subject. Nothing else. It is the only thing that cannot be externalized or projected into space and time and the only thing that cannot become an object. The character of selfhood is only in consciousness and that you cannot see in an external object. It cannot be seen in any object because the objects are outside consciousness. And consciousness does not want anything outside it because it is itself indivisible. So, it is the consciousness within you that is seeking the perfection that has been lost in the universal. It is the consciousness in you that meditates. It is the infinite within you that seeks the infinite without in meditation. Who is meditating? It is the infinite itself that is meditating. That is why it is not satisfied with objects. So you know how you can control the mind by a rational process of teaching the mind. Apart from pranayama, trataka, dieting, austerities of various kinds, etc., which are also helpful, this is a very philosophical and rational process of instructing the mind why it should not run after objects. Why objects cannot give you the satisfaction of having gained what you have lost and which you are seeking through meditation. How could the concept of space and time be overcome by a meditational process? How could the mind avoid getting into the belief into the reality of objects? by transcending the concept of space and time. Through a gradual methodology and technique, we overcome the limiting factor of space-time in meditation and commune ourselves with the object. The communion of the subject with the object is what is generally known as samadhi. It is the absorption of the subject with the object and vice versa. In this condition of the union of the subject and the object, the space-time limitation is lifted up, the screen is lifted, and you see yourself in union with what is really there outside. Unfortunately for us, what is there really in the object is what is really in us also. That is why the object is asking us to come to it and summoning it, summoning us. It is our own dear father and mother or brother or friend, whatever there is, whatever you call it, present in the object calling you, my dear friend, my dear child, come, you have left me and gone. That which is deepest in you is also the deepest in the objects. And the deepest in the object asks us to come to it, and that is the reason for desire. Desire has a very profound and rational basis, but it manifests itself in a very irrational manner. The reason for the manifestation of desire in the minds of people is the presence of the eternal, the absolute, the universal in the particular. But the reason behind the dissatisfaction that comes as a consequence of contact with objects is the divisibility of things, the impermanence of objects, and the belief that things are really external to consciousness. This is why contacts always lead you to suffering, misery. No one is happy merely by physical contact. The Bhagavad Gita tells us that contacts are wombs of pain. But we are always after contact. Visual contact, auditory contact, tactile contact, gustatory contact, olfactory contact, all are contacts only. But they are all creators of further suffering for us. Therefore, the yogi, the meditator, the seeker of truth or the sadhaka should learn the art of controlling the senses and seeking not pleasures in the objects of sense. The pleasure is not in the objects of sense. Mind, my dear mind, do not run after objects of sense. You will gain nothing from them. You will reap only misery. All is pain in this world, says Patanjali in one of his sutras, dukkham eva sarvam vivekina. All is pain because all contact is pain. All contact is pain because all contact is an unfortunately irrational and impossible attempt at contacting reality through the senses. You are trying to do this through the senses, you are impossible. Reality cannot be contacted through the senses merely because they are senses, merely because they seek only objects. The art or the technique that you can adopt in meditation for overcoming the condition of space-time and freeing the mind from this fickleness on account of which it runs to different objects is meditation on the connection of the object with yourself and the connection of the object with other objects. So that when you meditate on one object, it is as if you are meditating on all objects. Space and time are not going to defeat your process if this technique can be adopted in meditation. Just as you bring the analogy of dream once again, just as objects seen in dream are not independent of the space-time in dream, objects seen in waking also are not independent of the space-time in waking. They are mutually related. Space and time and objects and causality, these are all mutually related processes. One impossible without the other, and one becoming explicable when the other is explained. They rise and fall together, like the dream world. When the dream world rises, everything rises simultaneously. Space, time, causality, objects. At one moment you see everything. But when it stops or ceases or falls down, everything collapses at one second. The dream world collapses with all its spaces and times and objects and observers. The world is a simultaneous yugapat srishti, as Vedanta would tell us. When you see a world, you do not see only space first and time first or objects first. All things are seen together. You cannot see space without objects or objects without space and without causal relation, etc. This is a network. So when you meditate on this internal relationship of objects with the other factors, without which the existence of the object itself would be impossible, the mind would become calm. The mind becomes calm for want of objects. The objects excite and stimulate the mind. But if the objects have ceased to exist in the way they did earlier in this new meditational process, the mind has no reason to run after objects. This is the philosophical method, the Jnana Yoga method, usually called in meditation. There are various other methods also, to which we shall revert later on in our subsequent sittings. Today I have only confined myself to an explanation and discussion of the purely philosophical technique of contemplating by locating the object in its vital connection with the scheme of the whole cosmos, so that your meditation becomes a cosmic meditation, a Vaishvanara Vidya, you can call it in terms of the Upanishad. The Vaishvanara Vidya is cosmic or universal meditation practiced by the universal principle present in your own heart. God seeks God in your meditations. It is not man meditating on God. It is God himself meditating on himself, as it were. One thing cannot meditate on something else without an undercurrent of connection between the two elements. So, I conclude by saying that the world has become a fearful monster before us on account of our not understanding its makeup. We fear the world because we do not understand the world. We are completely out of tune with it and therefore out of touch with it, and so it has become a problem for us. We do not know what to do with this world. It has become a question which we cannot answer. But this question is arisen merely because of a problem that we have created within our own selves first. It is a purely subjective problem. And when that is solved, there is a simultaneous opening up of the mysteries objectively also, so that we are no more in a subjective world or an external world of objects, but we find ourselves in a system of universal relations, and then it is that we become blessed. Hari Om Tat Sat.